Talk given Sunday, 30th January, 1972.
The original teaching of the Veda gave rise first to those four great departments of Vedic literature, the Sanghita, that is the collection of hymns, especially of the Rig Veda, then ritual treatises known as the Brahmanas, which were followed by the records of the forest meditations of the sages called the Aranyakas, and the final exposition primarily in psychological and mystical terms, which we know as the Upanishads. Now, the Upanishads have been the real fount of creative inspiration for all the subsequent religious and philosophical teachings that sprang up in India. It is out of the Upanishadic teachings that there arose those two mighty streams of thought known as the Vedanta philosophy and the Sankhya philosophy. There were other systems too. The Nyaya, which is sometimes called the logical realism system. There was the Vaisheshika, which presented a pluralistic atomism. There was the Patanjali Yoga. There was the Sankhya, of course. And there was the Purva Mimamsa, which was the earlier Mimamsa, dealing more with the ritualistic aspects, and the Uttara Mimamsa, which was the subsequent Vedanta itself as such, which led ultimately to the great Shankaracharya. Now, it must not be thought that these systems were opposed to each other, or that they were quite different from each other. Every one of them quoted the Upanishads as authority, final authority, for their statements. And if not the Upanishads, it was the Rig Veda itself, the Veda. Now, I mention this because I would like to deal today with what some of you certainly have studied in other schools in connection with what are called the elements. The Vaisheshika, which is this pluralistic atomism, and the Sankhya particularly, give a presentation of the building up of a universe. Now, the Sankhya is called Sankhya because it just enumerates all the factors which go into the building up of a world, as they call it. If you look at it very carefully, as indeed if you look very carefully into any of the religio-philosophical systems, not the purely philosophical, which came much later in India, but any of the religio-philosophical systems of India, you will find that the word world or universe refers fundamentally and often exclusively to your own being. not to the world, the planet Earth on which we live, or the solar system, or the galaxies and so forth. They were not concerned with that. They thoroughly understood that the religious context is the context of individual awareness of existence. And it was the nature of your awareness with which they were concerned. Not as a scientific or a philosophic investigation, but in terms of understanding the meaning and purpose of our life and how it can be brought to fulfillment. They were essentially psychological at root. This must be carefully borne in mind. And this is one of the great mistakes made by scholars and many others who found various schools, whether it be in the East or in the West. The mistake they make, namely that they associate the word world or universe with the external, material, physical world which we experience. Now, you may say, how can that be? Because they do talk about the great earth, they do talk about the sky and the atmosphere and so forth. Perfectly true, they do talk about it. But note very carefully that they talk about it in terms of your picture in your mind of the world. When we look at any object, in the ordinary way, the man in the street, the intelligent man in the street, believes he is looking at the object, that he knows the object. Now, it is perfectly true that the gaze of his eyes is directed towards a physical object. But what the man in the street does not know, and frequently has not the slightest inkling of, is this: that that object which sends forth rays of light by reflection to his eyes make an impact on his brain, and this impact of so many vibrations, electrical play of great electrical forces, is interpreted psychically by him in the words, I see so and so. What he is actually seeing is not the object in itself exactly as it is in its own absolute being, but he is seeing his mental image. Now you see, if this were not the case, any two people would give an identical description of what the object was. If indeed an ordinarily healthy pair of eyes looked at an object and another pair of eyes looked at an object, and the person said, I see this, and the other person said, I see this, that seeing, if it was an absolute seeing of the object as object only and nothing else, would give the identical description of it. You see? But they don't. This is simply due to the fact, and we now know for a fact, that what we see, what we hear, touch, taste, smell, and then say, I hear, touch, taste, smell, this, that, or the other, I'm merely talking about the impress made upon my own brain, interpreted by my own psyche. I'm talking about myself. Now, if we understand this, we will understand that when the old people talked about Maya, the illusory nature of the world and of things, they did not mean that this physical earth or the stars or the suns or anything at all was an illusion. It was a fact. Something was there. But what I see, or hear, or touch, is my own image in my mind. And my image is not absolutely true to the fact. Now, do you get it? This is the real way to understand the word Maya. The psychical part of me gives an illusory picture. It gives me a falsified account of the actual fact, that the actual fact I don't know. What Immanuel Kant, for instance, in the West, centuries later, almost 30 centuries later, called things in themselves. We don't know them. So, things in themselves are, but our pictures of them are illusory. Our observations, our sense functioning, has this illusion-raising element in it. So this is Maya. Is that quite clear? So now, this world which they talked of was essentially and fundamentally yourself. And why were they concerned with that? Why, in fact, is all religion concerned with that? Because it is you and I, as living beings, who have problems, who have confusions, frustrations, fears. We wonder, what is the purpose of our existence? Why are we here? Why is there suffering above all? Why is there pain, distress, and so forth? It is only we who ask that question. This tape recorder or this microphone doesn't ask it. That bookcase or this floor doesn't ask that question. The trees don't ask that question. Even most of the animals don't ask that question. It is human beings alone who ask that question. It is in the human mind and in the human psyche that there arises confusion, there arises discord, and the individual being, the human, is conscious of that discord. If an animal experiences something unpleasant or discordant, it either moves away from it if it can, which is what it usually does, or it fights against it, it just opposes it. It's as simple and naive as that. With us it isn't so. The animal doesn't wait to question, why did this happen to me or anything. It has no self-consciousness in that sense. We have it. So you see, all these problems arise. Then there arose other problems too. The great question, who am I? What am I? What is the purpose of my existence here? If such and such is the purpose, then how best shall I fulfill it? How does it square up with my natural drives and urges and desires and so forth? You see, all these things sprang up. And so, in the attempt to understand them, there arose all the great religio-philosophical systems. And do remember that right up till the time of Plato, contemporary with Christ too, practically all philosophical systems were at base religious philosophic systems. They were not pure intellectualist academic philosophy as we understand philosophy in modern times. They were not. They were concerned with man, with fundamental things. Ontology, that means questions as regards ultimate things, underlay every such teaching which came about. Now, understanding that and keeping in mind that that is the basis of it all, we can look at this question of the elements which the old people talked about. You know what what they said. Earth, water, light or fire, air, and they talked about, to use the Greek word, ether. The Indian word is akasha. Air is vayu. Light or fire is tejas. Water is apas. And earth is prithvi. Now, if you look at the Sankhya philosophy particularly, you will find it stated in such a way that if you take it in a literal sense, you will be up against the sheerest nonsense. See, it starts off with the affirmation of prakruti, primordial nature. Then it goes on developing it in an intellectualist philosophical manner and asserts that there is the production of what are called the tanmatras, the subtle elements, out of which came the gross elements, namely ether, air, light, water, earth. And they proceed to give a pseudo-scientific account of how the atoms combined in order that this world, this whole world, is produced. They associated ether, akasha, with sound. They called it the origin of sound. They escaped saying that it is the medium through which sound is conveyed to us. That would have been utterly false, because sound is not conveyed through akasha. Sound does not travel through a vacuum. It does not travel through empty space. It needs material particles, gaseous, solid, or liquid, through which to be transmitted and make an impress upon the ear. It's only when sound is converted into electrical impulses, and then the electrical impulses are reconverted back into the ordinary sound vibrations, that we get our modern phenomena of a telephone and all the rest of it. You see, they associated akasha with sound and with the human ear. Air they associated with motion, with movement, with the skin, with touch. They associated light or fire with the eye. Plato does the same, if you study the dialogues carefully, with the eye and with form and color. They associated the water element, apas, with taste, with the tongue, with the idea of cohesion. And they associated earth with smell, with the nose. Now you see, all this is obviously just a made-up thing. It is, as the Buddha used to say, it is a sankata, a put-together. It's just so many words, so many ideas, just put together like that and built up into a system. Now, I believe some of you present have come across all this. You have studied it in your own circles. But beware of taking this as truth in the sense in which it is presented to us, as if it were true. This is a verbal put together. If we take it literally, especially if we take it literally, and it has no relationship with reality. Because the whole idea of atoms of earth, water, light, air, we know is just absolute nonsense with our modern knowledge. There is no such thing as an atom of air or an atom of earth. No such thing whatsoever. And an atom is no longer an atom, even in the simple sense in which it was presented, both in India and by the Greeks, that it is an ultimate particle which is indivisible, that it is created by God, it is eternal after that, it is indivisible, invisible, and of an ultimate, infinitely small size. All that is nonsensical. The atoms that we know today, scientifically, are congeries of energy, of force. And our words, matter, particle, and so on, simply do not apply at all. They are all misleading. They are all false, if interpreted in the ordinary dictionary sense of the word. So you see, as far as its literal interpretation is concerned, or even so many of the explanations of these things which have been offered as a symbolical system are concerned, we are wise to reject the whole lot just like that. They are meaningless. One of the earliest to reject them was the Buddha himself. He said, put aside all these speculations. You don't know. I haven't seen any record in the Pali Canon to suggest that he also said that you cannot know. He said, you don't know. Leave it alone. This is not conducive to your purification, to freeing yourself from the bonds of desire. It is not conducive to the destruction of greed, hate, and delusion, to the realization of nirvana. Not conducive to it. So put it aside. Now, it is true that the Buddha said those things. But if you look at a good deal of Buddhist teaching, you will find that certain features, the implied metaphysics in the Buddha's ethical teachings, is identical with the Sankhya metaphysical presentation. If you look at the Gita, there too you will find some of the main elements of the Sankhya teaching about Mahat, the great intelligence, and the elements and all the rest of it, all coming in. Krishna affirms that this is the field in which I function, and so forth. But they come in a manner, they are presented in a manner which is considerably different from the Sankhya manner. And also different from the way in which the Buddha approached it. I'm saying all this to suggest to you that it is no good taking hold of a particular little system as presented by any one school of thought or system of philosophy or anything, and sticking to that, and here we have the truth. You may remember at our last meeting I said that whosoever says this is the truth is making a false statement altogether. You see? So, if one is interested in finding out what might be the underlying meaning of all these things, from the study point of view, one should go into all the different related systems which exist. If you want to know Sankhya properly, you must start right with the Rig Veda and the Upanishads and go through Sankhya, Yoga, Nyaya, Vaisheshika, Purva and Uttara Mimamsas. You must go through all that in order to begin to see light. And the way to see light is to remember that all these presentations are concerned with you yourself, your life, your psychological processes particularly. Because consider the significance of relating the elements to the different sense functions to start with. Why should you? How can you relate solid matter? Now, here we live in modern times. Solid matter, earth, solid matter. How can we relate that to our sense of smell? What has it got to do with smell? And what on earth has what is called ether? In the last century, we used to call it the luminiferous ether because we believed that there was a real medium called ether through which light rays passed and all the rest of it. What on earth has that got to do with sound? Nothing at all. How can it be related to your sense of hearing? How can water be related to your sense of taste? We all know that pure water is a tasteless substance. There is no taste to it. You see? So we must put aside all those ideas. But when you make, even arbitrarily, psychological correspondences to the elements and talk of the building of a world through the elements as corresponding to the building of the structure, the growth of your own psychophysical being, then there is something which is worthwhile there, and we could understand it. It's a roundabout route. And there is no special point in trying to work out exact correspondences and seeing, this means this and this means that. Now I'll tell you why that is, again, a way which only leads us into confusion. Who is trying to find out, to make the correspondences and declare that these are the true correspondences? You are, I am. But unless you are omniscient and know the truth, the fact, unless I am omniscient and know the truth or fact, I will superimpose all my foolishnesses, my ignorances and all the rest of it upon the system. Invariably, inevitably. The whole progress of knowledge through the ages has been just that story. What happens with the growth of knowledge? It supplants the mistakes in the old knowledge, doesn't it? Now, what do we do in the ordinary way? We go to a society, we take to a system or whatever it is and say, this is the truth, the final truth. But this is ordinary human stupidity. Right from the time the first man existed. you will appreciate why I say that one of the first rules of spiritual living, never take leave of good sense. I can't repeat that too often. Never take leave of good sense. The more clever we are, the more we feel, we've got hold of the real thing, the real teacher, all the rest of it, you see, the more we feel that, the more deluded we are. So be very careful about all such presentations and systems and so on. Be very careful. By all means study them. By all means look into them. And in the looking into them, discover what you yourself are. Discover how is my own mind functioning. What are my own prejudices, my biases, my confusions, my fears, my conditioning? How is it all reacting to what I am studying? Because it will reveal the nature of the workings of my own being. And this, which is self-knowledge, in the sense of knowledge of what I am now, at this moment, it is this which is the real power to liberate one out of misery, sorrow, ignorance, fear, insecurity of the soul, and all that sort of. See? You know, when earlier on, when you first came, I used to say again and again, you must not take me as a teacher. I refuse to be regarded as a teacher or one who knows better or any such nonsense. We meet together because we are all interested together in a common interest, which we name truth, which we may name transcendence, which we may name liberation, and so forth. And because we really care for that, there is a kind of a transcendental power of love which draws us together. That is why we meet. If I may put it in these words, we meet for God's sake, not for our sakes. You see? And therefore, if we meet in that way, and one of us happens to be a speaker, actually, all of us are participating in that process. I am only a mouthpiece. That's all. It is our one soul, our one transcendent mind, so to say, which is trying to express itself, to flower out through each and every one of us. Now that way we can investigate together and investigate in the right manner, that is always ready to discard what we see is not so true as we thought it was. So now, back to these elements. Now, one thing before we actually touch upon some of the main aspects in connection with the elements that I want to touch upon today. Bear in mind what I said earlier, that the Buddha's teaching has considerable affinity with Sankhya, and also with yoga. Now, of course, Sankhya and yoga have also considerable affinity with the basic Hindu teachings as such. And all of them stem back into the Upanishads and the Rig Veda. We can't get away from that fact. Now, the difference is like this. In Buddhism, there is neither Purusha, the person, nor is there Ishvara, a creator god. God as a personal being who created the universe and runs it. Those two are out. In yoga, we have both Purusha and Ishvara. But Ishvara only as a convenient subject for meditation, for concentrating attention. Only in that sense. And in Sankhya, you have only Purusha. So, yoga has both Purusha and Ishvara. The person and the creator God. Yoga has both. Sankhya has no God, creator God. It has the person, Purusha. And Buddhism discards both. All three are right, and all three could be righter. Now approach it that way, with a completely open mind, a free mind. Now let's come to these elements. These elements, presented by the ancients, earth, water, fire, and so on, they are convenient words which we can use for our purposes. The Buddha, for instance, and it's the same in the Yoga Upanishads, you will find it through and through. You will find it stated that the body is composed of hard substances, bones, teeth, and so on. This belongs to earth. This is the earthy part. The body consists of blood, phlegm, synovial fluid, lymph, and all the rest of it. All that is the liquid part. And all that is lumped under the one word water. That's the water element. Well, you know all that, so there's no point in my going on repeating that. So you get all these different elements as such, composing the body. You see? And they have their own particular characteristics and qualities. Now, instead of trying to build universes, build worlds, as presented in Sankhya, for instance, and so forth, although the esoteric part of Sankhya is forgotten, that is at one with the Vedanta and the Buddha's teaching also, actually, because it is concerned with your liberation. And in your liberations, the Purusha has reached the stage of perfect aloneness, detachment from all that binds, you see. All right. Putting that aside, let us look at the way the Buddha presented the elements, whenever he talked about them, in whichever form he talked. Whether he talked about the elements purely as elements, earth, air, fire, water, and so on, or whether he talked about them in terms of the psychophysical correspondence to them. That is to say, the physical body is earth. Vedana, the feelings, are perhaps like water. The sannyavi ideas are like air, and so forth. Vijnana, consciousness, perhaps like akasha, and so forth. You get it? So that earth, air, fire, water for him meant this rather than any other thing. And why did it mean this for the Buddha? Because he was concerned with your realization of nirvana. Your freedom from suffering, from the ill state. He was concerned with that. Therefore, he presented it this way. All right. Now, let us take the elements as elements in our ordinary everyday life. I have already said that our knowledge of all this is in terms of our mind picture about it all, not the thing itself. when we handle a stone or look at a stone, that stone is not the stone in itself, but the impress on my brain and the interpretation by my psyche, which uses, of course, my speech faculty in order to describe. Hence the tremendous importance of the speech faculty. See? That's what it is. It's in my mind like that. Now, supposing we take an element like earth, something solid. There are so many solid things that play their part in our life. In this room, for instance, there are chairs, there's a piano, there are bookcases, there are books, there's a desk, and so forth. How do I approach them all? Now, the Buddha was specially concerned with this, because this touches the whole problem of liberation. How do I approach them? This is my piano. Actually, I don't approach anything like that here. You may notice in my conversation, I rarely say even my wife. I always refer to her by name. Only occasionally I force myself to say my wife, otherwise I might not be properly understood. I don't say my piano, I say the piano, the room, the house. I just happen to be old enough now to have freed myself from the possessiveness involved. But in the ordinary way, as an ordinary man of the world, this is my piano, my books. You see? My Ming vase or my tanka which the Dalai Lama's nephew presented. Now just think of all the psychological process that is involved in that attitude, that approach, and that sort of conversation and description of these things. It's possessive. And if it is possessive, the whole complex of qualities which derive from lust or greed are all involved, aren't they? Every one of them is involved. In saying my piano, I have dispossessed everybody else in relationship to that particular piano. It is my exclusive possession. And if it is my exclusive possession, what do I do if anybody comes to take it? You see the situation? It's a situation of bondage. It's a situation which gives rise to anxiety. For instance, supposing there is a servant in the house who is a very nasty person, and there is cause to believe that this one will do some harm, you see, and the servant will know that if he or she damages the piano, it could be an irreparable damage, can hurt me that way. So I shall be in a state of anxiety about it, won't I? So you see how the whole complex of qualities which derive from greed are, how that whole complex is involved in my approach, my piano. There is no freedom, there is anxiety. And with it is associated a state of sorrow. Also, if the piano gets a scratch, I am annoyed, I am upset, and so forth. Why couldn't that foolish fellow watch how he went past that piano instead of letting his metal buttons make a scratch across the surface and all the rest of it? Isn't that so? But you see, we approach earth, the entire solid world, all the world which is in the solid state, in that way. Isn't that the same with the element water? Take, for instance, a simple thing like this. If you feel thirsty, how does one approach the situation? Oh, I am perishing with thirst. I must have a glass of water. Or whatever it be, Ribena or whiskey or whatever you take, or gin and tonic or anything. This gives me away, doesn't it? It clearly shows how I'm a person who never goes to a pub. I didn't mention beer. Oh, Lord, yes, that's the marvelous, that's the right thing to mention. My beer. Now, this phrase has real significance because millions of people are conscious in terms of my beer, my pint. All right. My pint. What is the approach to the element water? The element which is liquid. If I don't get my pint, what do I feel about it? Or if I have to stand too many pints because there are too many friends around about me in the pub at the same time, what am I thinking of? The lightening of my pocket, of my purse. And so on and so on. I suppose people do think of these things. I don't, because I never go to a pub. But there we are. Now, these elements, so solid, liquid, gaseous, and if you like to use modern terms, you know, you can say the metals, the non-metals, you can say pressures, temperatures, electrical energies, chemical, electrochemical processes, and all the rest of it. You can use those terms, modern terms. But they amount to the same thing. How do we approach it all? What is our relationship to it all? Is it not a relationship of bondage? Now, the study of the elements, then, if it is not to be merely an intellectual indulgence, intellectual debauchery, if you like, if it is not to be merely that, the study of the elements means, really, the process of understanding oneself all the time. Understand oneself. And in that understanding, all that is entangled, knotted up, becomes unknotted gradually. And there is peace in oneself, the living person. Take a magnificent example of it, which is very topical. Property. The rise in prices, house property, houses and land and so forth. This rocketing up of prices. What is it a manifestation of? Greed and exploitation. There are no real values involved in it at all. People in a state of fear, of a need, of which they have no proper evaluation or judgment, are exploited by others who just raise up the prices. And so this mad situation arises. It's all humbug from beginning to end. There's no reality about it. None whatever. Supposing one brings forward the cliché. Ah, well, you see, it's a case of supply and demand. If you demand something which is difficult to produce, which is short in supply, which is something rare or exotic or something, you see, then you have to pay more for it. I want caviar. I want caviar is true, but I don't need caviar. What the body needs for its existence is food. But nobody has laid down that it must have caviar. You see, the element there involved is greed all along the line. And if the greed is frustrated, then resentment, hate, and all that complex of qualities which comes under the word hate, all that is involved. Just because of certain elements which we desire. We are bound to them. And so one can go on with all the elements. We should also mention the non-physical side. Take the element air, which is associated with thought, ideas, and so forth. What are thoughts? What are systematized thoughts, philosophies and so forth, beliefs, doctrines, dogmas, convictions. All these come in association with the word air. Take again the what we call that inner sense in us which absolutely convinces us that there is God or something transcendent or the divine and all the rest of it. You can associate that, if you like, with the element ether. All right. Now, what is my approach to God? To the transcendent. To the Buddha nature. To the Christ consciousness. All transcendent things. What is my approach to it? I must find God. Comes the neurotic shouting away. Why must you find God? God's not interested in you. Supposing that were the case. Doesn't care two hoots about you. What then? Why must I find God? You see, the approach is wrong, isn't it? The approach is rooted in lust and in ego. I. But as long as I remain stuck fast in this solidified mud of ego, I am done for. I can't move at all. No. You see the great lesson underlying all this in the study of the elements? To be free of all grasping. Let go. The universe won't disappear at all if you let go. You don't have to hold fast to it. The planet will be there, the sun will be there, everything is there. Whatsoever is here for oneself, let us be satisfied with it. You know, you look into the Upanishads, for instance, to give you just one example, the Shandilya Upanishad. And if you look into the less complete accounts, as for instance you find in the Yoga Aphorisms of Patanjali, one of the great yamas, that is to say, observances, the disciplines, preliminary discipline, remember. One of the great teachings about it is just this. Be content with whatsoever is there, available for oneself, for one's needs. Be content with that and make the best of it. Don't hanker after, don't lust after other things. If one is free and poised within oneself, what is really needful for one will come of its own accord. This is a law of nature, if you like, if I may be permitted to use that phrase, law of nature. Now I'll tell you what I mean by this statement. All that is needful will come. That is the statement. What is the needful? This is the great question. Here am I, a living being. The fundamental purpose which is emerging through my living process is to learn in such a manner that the truth, whatever it may be, can manifest itself through this living person. Now, in order that such learning may take place, I must keep all my senses awake. I must remain wide awake, mindful, observant, without grasping, without demanding, expecting, hoping, etc. Certainly without planning, either for myself or for my children or my friends or anybody. Now, when your consciousness is in this state of freedom, you are in the pure state. You are in a state of purity. And in that state of purity, enlightenment emerges. And you are content with whatsoever is. You see, this is not easy. It's very difficult. But all of you feel that you seek the way. But remember those great words. The way is not straight. It is straight. It's a razor-edged path. And that path takes you nowhere outside yourself. That path is all within your own being. And it is this process of understanding the self, of letting the self be so utterly purified, that the truth, the transcendent reality, whatever it is, which I don't know and can never know in its transcendence, manifests itself through my living psychophysical organism, this living person. Now you see, in order that that may happen, whatsoever is needful for this organism, in its particular circumstance and situation, is present there. This is divine contentment. Let go within the psyche, within the soul. Don't grasp at anything. Don't hold on to anything. Because the poisoned barb of desire will ruin your living process. Otherwise, whatever may happen outwardly in the shape of success or fulfilled desire, will someday, somehow, somewhere, somewhen, turn to dust and ashes, to nostalgic memories, to remorse, to the painful stab of unfulfillment now because I am old and decrepit and incapable of the things that I enjoyed in my stupid, senseless, lusty youth. Make no mistake about it. I know this inner happiness. It's not something acquired, gained, achieved, attained. It is there. And it is there. And I'm fully awake to it. Simply because I've seen the falsity of the other thing. I didn't have to push it aside. That other thing, in actual fact, was not the external thing. It was my own misconception, my false images inside my own mind. When you cease to grasp earth, the whole earth is yours. When you cease to grasp water and air and ether and everything, the totality is yours. And it is yours unpossessively. It doesn't need guarding. It doesn't need preserving. It doesn't need holding. This means that you live in terms of everlasting life. Don't you see? The freedom, the peace, the happiness of it. The happiness which can never be given, can never be taken away. It is there, natural. It's the natural state. So, in studying the elements, study them intelligently, not intellectually, but intelligently, with the right approach, free of grasping, of acquiring, free of the absurd beliefs that, if I go through this course, week after week, month after month, year after year, at the end of that course, some marvelous enlightenment, happiness will come, and so forth. Not a bit of it. Because every thought I have about it, every grasping that I have in relation to it, every demand I make upon it, makes up the chains of bondage for me myself, instead of freedom. Don't you see? Drop the load. It's so easy. Just drop it. We are often told that we care for the wrong things. Let me put it this way. We miscare for everything. If we truly cared, if we truly loved, there'd be complete freedom, no grasping, no bondage. You all know from your own living experience how when you really loved somebody, you just naturally gave without expecting a return, without even the demand or the hope that, this wonderful state can be preserved. Because that's the very difficult part of the story. Since I've said that, look at the way in which we approach marriage, for instance. To have and to hold forever. What can you have and hold forever? your own imprisonment almost forever. Pure love is pure wisdom. And it is non-grasping. It is freeing yourself from the tentacles of desire. Any and every desire. The desire for God is just as binding as the desire for the bottle. I don't mean the baby's bottle. See? You don't desire space, do you? It is there absolutely all the time. You couldn't get rid of it if you wanted to. Similarly, you don't need to desire God or liberation or transcendence or anything. And certainly, one can be free if we are even half intelligent. We can be free of desiring the different elements. Things solid, liquid, gaseous, this enjoyment, that situation, this pleasure, that delight, this security, and all the rest of it. Do the right thing, you will be secure. You can't do any better. And that's that. If you've left the car door unlocked, well, it is unlocked, all right. Just be calm and quiet, content. Now, here is the situation. You can't escape it. When you go back to the car, see what's happened and learn the lesson. Not remorse and vain regrets. Mindfulness, awakenedness, so that never again does one leave the car door unlocked. That's all. Learn. And in that process of learning, you meet your teacher, your guru. Who is your teacher, your guru? Not Bhikkhu so-and-so or Roshi so-and-so. Not Professor so-and-so. Not Krishnamurti or Firoz Mehta or Jesus Christ or the Buddha or anybody. Your teacher is life in its totality. Every single thing teaches you if you learn. If you don't learn, nothing teaches you. It can't. It is my act of learning which makes everything and everyone, all of you, my teachers. This is in the religious context, in the religious sense. In the ordinary dualistic sense, within the dualistic sphere, if you want to learn algebra or medicine or engineering or cookery or whatever it is, of course you go to the person who possesses the skill and that person hands over the skill to you. But in this religious context, which is the context of your liberation out of bondage into the enlightened state, into the purified state, nothing can be handed over to you. It is your living process. And your living process is just your process. Nobody can hand it to you. You see, these are the important things, really. If you understand all this as the basis, then by all means read all the books in the world that you want and enjoy them and understand. Otherwise, they are a burden, they are a bondage. I can't quite remember where, I can't remember chapter and verse, but somewhere I believe in the Upanishads, the great sage says, first, the realization of Brahman. Then let any pleasures come, let any sorrows come. It's all the same.
Understand?
So do consider this very carefully. And if I may suggest, as a subject which would be a very useful subject for meditation during the coming fortnight, observe all your psycho-mental associations with everything that you come across, every state of mind that you go through. Observe the psycho-mental associations. And I'm using the words, this double-barrel psycho-mental, I'm using it somewhat arbitrarily in a special sense. And I'm doing so arbitrarily because it may prove very helpful to you. The psycho part you understand, your psychological reactions. A stimulus comes, you see something in the shop window, say, and there's a reaction in your mind towards it, you see. The liking, the disliking, the criticism, the this, that, and the other, and so forth, and so forth. All right. That is just the psychological part. Now, there is a mental part in a transcendent sense. I'm not using the word mental in the ordinary sense of the word. I'm using it in the transcendent sense. Transcendent mind interacting with your living being is interpreted by your own psyche as an ideal, an ought to be. Now, whether that ideal, that ought to be, is in the sphere of the next hat you want to buy, or the meal you want to take, or the book that you want to study, or whatever it is, that makes no difference. But note the influence of this ought to be in your psychical process as you react to the circumstance, to the stimulus, to the person or the object. Just note that carefully. This play of the ought to be with the natural, ordinary, physical, psychical reaction. Get it? Now just watch that very carefully and see how the ought to be is a troublesome factor, although we call it the ideal, the perfect thing. There is no ideal which has final warrant in truth. Where truth is concerned, all ideals vanish. They all disappear because they are all mind-made. That is to say, they are pictures. They are fossilized things set up by my mind. Ah, that's the perfect ought to be. But what is my mind? Imperfect. And how can the imperfect mind ever set up the ought to be which is the perfect? Quite impossible. Therefore, let it be free, let it be plastic. Now, we all have this ought to be. And it will reveal wonderful things to you, your own conditioning, your own bondages, and all the rest of it. And if you carry this out, even for a fortnight, strenuously, you will find extraordinary freedom emerging. And may you be happy with it.